Welcome back to another episode of Scrappy Startups. With me today is the co-founder and executive chair of Kscope.ai, Yonatan Hagos. Kscope is a technology startup. It is a next-generation platform for connecting data across a business using AI. Founded a few years ago, it is truly a scrappy startup. We'll hear about Yonatan, about his personal entrepreneurial journey from being in large companies to becoming a real estate entrepreneur and moving on to being a technology entrepreneur. He will share lessons learned on finding a focus, testing messaging, how to create a startup with virtual teams, developing meaningful partnerships, and funding strategy. So let's jump into the interview with Yonatan. So welcome, Yonatan, and we're really excited to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me, Bill. I really appreciate it.
Your journey has taken you where you're much more entrepreneurial, both in real estate and in tech. But early in your career, you were more big company guy. How did you go through that shift? Are you happy you made that shift? Do you think you'll shift back?
Yeah, it wasn't architected this way, but I am incredibly happy that I made the shift. You know, I think fundamentally what has always driven me is two factors, right? One is just I have this, you know, blessing curse, which is this insatiable curiosity. So I'm always wanting to learn. I'm not afraid of failing. So I just, you know, I throw myself at things and I learn and I take lessons from that and I try to apply it to other areas. I'm a huge history buff. So I read all the time about different, you know, things. And so, but you know, for me, I think there were a couple of pivotal moments. One was the, you know, 2000, when all the crisis were going on, that was, you know, early in my career. I had left Deloitte, I think, in 21 and gotten into corporate America. And the reason I left wasn't that I didn't like consulting. I just felt like I wanted to see how companies actually operate. So I wanted to get behind the scenes. And that was a great experience. And so I got into corporate finance, which was really awesome because you touch everything. And I love that. And then from that, as my career progressed and I was having actually more and more success, there were more push to go to a CFO route. And I wanted to do more. And so one of my mentors, John Schwartz at Business Objects, I went to get his advice and probably one of the best advice I've ever gotten. And I said, I want to be a CEO. I don't want to be, it wasn't necessarily CEO. I wanted to be operational. And he said, well, then I'm going to tell you, very inconvenient fact, you're going to have to quit your job. And I was like, what? He's like, yeah, you're going to have to go in there. And he said, you know, if you want to be a CEO or if you want to be on the operations side, he said, I recommend two things. So either control the customer interaction, you know, you really have to own that relationship, or you have to control the product. And ideally, you get a good grasp of both. And that has been, it's been the best guidance I've ever gotten in my life. And so I went, you know, I had great relationship with the executive board at the time. And so I went into and we were building products for people like me. So it was easy to go onto the product side. And so I worked for a gentleman by the name of Mark Dahl, who had started a new business unit within Business Objects. And it was, you know, around enterprise performance management. I was doing this for a living. So I was the customer. So I came in at it from the voice of the customer, very product, customer centric, you know, problem centric rather than technology centric. And I wasn't a technologist, so it was relatively easy to do. But you had to win everybody else to let you participate. And so that was a very challenging part, but that really just kind of opened up a lot of doors for me. And then I got a chance to go interact with customers, and that gave me even more excitement about doing that. And it was just a fun journey. And then, you know, I was always interested in real estate, mostly because I think I lived some very interesting times. So when I moved to the Bay Area to go to Berkeley, we had just gone through a couple of crises. So 89, there was the crash, in the Bay Area market, real estate market, right, because of the earthquake. And then 90, you had the war. And so real estate in the Bay Area was just, you know, was a disaster, right? And I came from LA and I just didn't understand. I said, how is it that, you know, place in right by the school, you could buy it for $100,000. You can't find anything in Los Angeles for $300,000-$400,000. It didn't make any sense to me. And then I was an economics student, so I started learning about arbitrage and I started understanding about opportunities. And so that always piqued my interest. And I didn't have two pennies to rub together, so I didn't buy anything at the time. But, you know, But it always stayed with me. And so that, you know, and I always feel like there are always markets where there are bull markets in everything. It's just whatever intrigues you. So I just kind of, you know, curiosity and then things that drive me. And then the second one has always been purpose, right? So I always took jobs where I felt like we're doing something meaningful, you know, and to me, you know, data and analytics have always been a big part of my life because it improves decision-making. So how do you enable people to make better decisions? So that always stayed with me. And so, you know, I didn't really know that when I got into it. It was sort of fortuitous, but I got into Business Objects, which was the number one BI platform at the time. And we had expanded that by bringing in the data, you know, data cleansing, the DI and all that part. And then we had expanded into EPM and, you know, so that, and then when I went, you know, I had a shot at that. I was doing more packaged applications on a data warehouse that was built, you know, on the Business Object stack. So that's been kind of like the beginning of my journey. And so data has always been a core part. And then the rest of it is just curious, you know, just, you know, I find something interesting. I owned a bar at one point. I didn't know if you know this or not. And I had no idea on what happened on the other side other than I knew how to drink well on the other side, you know. But it just, you know, just curiosity, I think, is the curiosity and purpose have been really a key part of my whole journey.
How did you decide to just go into the real estate entrepreneur business? And are you doing any of that still?
I am. So, you know, again, I think fortunate. So I was, you know, I was investing in the stock market and all that. And it was okay, but it wasn't, you know, it just wasn't as interesting. But the real estate market was always interesting to me. You know, I was macroeconomics, history is always a big thing for me. So it's kind of easy for me to see certain trends. I don't know why. But even now, like, you know, people are scared of what's going on in the retail or the commercial space. And I'm like, there's a ripe opportunity right there. Right. So 2000s, you know, everybody was trying to get out and I was trying to gather as much money as I could so I could buy as much property as I could. And so I got lucky. I picked up a couple of duplexes and fourplexes, and I didn't have money to hire people to go do the work. So on the weekends, you know, I was doing basically ripping out the carpets and painting walls and, you know, and then you just learn. And then you learn where you get the best windows from. You learn. And so you could do what it would take to do $100,000, $200,000 in renovation. You do it for $50,000 or $40,000. And so now you start to, you know, you see that grow. And then you also start to, you know, the other side of it was really purpose. And I really think the housing crisis that we have is really a man-made crisis, right? And so my journey has kind of took me to that now where I work a lot more with nonprofits. And also I'm doing some stuff in affordable housing, mostly workforce housing. I'm not a big fan of low-income housing. I think there's a lot of things wrong with it, both from a policy and just from a structure. And so I don't do any of that. And I don't really do things for money if I don't believe in it. But workforce housing, I think, is critical. I mean, we have huge shortage in people that are making below 120% of AMI or below 80% of AMI. So we, you know, I'm working with some nonprofits, with some for-profit developers, trying to bring up some properties that are in the 80% of AMI. And luckily, you know, the state of California is starting to lean forward and remove a lot of the barriers. And so just getting into that space. But I still do the other rentals as well. And one of the things that I've learned is if you think about housing as a service, just like software or anything else, and you provide value service and you work with your people when, you know, when the economy is, you know, you're not just trying to get rid of people, you know, and obviously you're going to have tough folks and you're going to have tough conversations. But if you think about it as a service provider, then it changes your perspective. It changes your relationship. People stay for 5 years, you know, and every time you don't have to have 3 months to turn somebody over, it's a benefit. So it's an opportunity to also show that at GE, you know, you allowed me to lead the emerging verticals, and you know, we had some good success in that, and all these things just build confidence, and they, you know, they enable you to think that you can, okay, we can go do this somewhere else. And you know, so I appreciate the opportunity you afforded me. So that was, you know, that was amazing.
Well, thank you. But so, you know, now you've got this new endeavor, kscope.ai, and so tell me, how did that get formed? And you know, what has been the journey to get to where you are today?
Yeah, so it really is a culmination of experiences, but the brain behind it, the brain or the formation really is Suparna's, right? Suparna is my co-founder and the CEO. And he and I have worked, we actually worked together at GE, and this is probably the third startup that he and I have thought about or started. And some of them we put on ice, they're not dead yet. But at the core of it was, you know, the data complexity and the data issue. It has always been a theme for us. So whether it's in industrial, whether it's in healthcare, whether it's in security. And so we look at it and a lot of folks are trying to solve them as, you know, siloed issues rather than looking at it as a systematic issue. And then we had some core assumptions. Complexity is not going to go away. Data volumes are not going to go down. Velocity of how data is getting created isn't going to get slower. And so if all of these things are true, then can we continue to do things the way we're doing it and be successful? And we thought, you know, there are a lot of great companies that are solving it different ways. So if you look at, you know, the Palantirs of the world, the Cognites of the world, they're amazing. They're doing a great job, you know, in serving their customers. But we still felt like there was a gap, you know. And then there are new players like the Wizards of the world that are very, you know, security focused, but they're actually using modern technology to shortcut a lot of the things that we saw. So from that, a lot of discussions evolved. And so the three co-founders, Zubair, who's our CTO, Suparna, and myself, really got, you know, they started it. And I actually was an advisor initially because I was working at an AI company. But we spent a lot of time just iterating on what's really our differentiator? What is our value proposition? Why are we different than anyone else? And we came to a couple of key nuggets that we continue to build on. So the one differentiator for us is being able to connect disparate systems. So, and everybody says, well, you can move the data. No, no. How do you get real-time view across all of your systems? And this, the number of systems you're going to have is just going to increase. So how are you able to interact with these systems, pull information in real time, and be able to add value to the decision-making process? And so from that, the notion of blueprints was invented. And so these blueprints are connectors, but they're really not connectors. They're really intelligent AI-based systems that go out, crawl your environment, and then they understand the context of where they are, right? So they understand the schema, they understand the relationship between the data, and so they bring back a subset of the metadata, not all of your data, and they also bring back your streaming data or your events streams. And so once you have that, then you can look at different systems and you could see, okay, well, this data element here and this data element here is the same because now you can correlate them across. And then we have a series of bots that go through and do the correlation. Once you've correlated that, you know, you've created, and we use the graph databases. And so all these graph, you have a sort of a small graph for each of these systems with a subset of the data. And then you bring it together. So you have this virtual data graph that connects all of them. And now you have the relationship. And now you have a contextual understanding of how all these data elements are connected, right? And that allows you to understand it in both directions. So if there's an issue, you can traverse back and say, okay, well, what were the causes? Or you can look at the linearity of issues. If you have a supply chain issue, you can identify it and, you know, ahead of time. So, you know, so that's been the basis of it. And then there are different ways to interact with the system. So you can have AI models that interact with the system and you can just, you know, type questions just like you can with ChatGPT or anything else, and it interrogates that data. And then everything is in a private LLM, so nothing goes back to any private public. And or we have what we call standing queries. So we have these analyzers that you can either train with your best practices or regulations or rules. And so if you're doing security, there are a bunch of standards you have to follow. And so instead of you having to create dashboards and things and you know, and map it, it'll automatically understand. And then it'll say, okay, you're violating these conditions, and it'll alert you. So these are standing queries that'll automatically alert you. And then it'll also give you recommended remediation. And so, you know, the basic construct is horizontal, right? It doesn't matter which industry you're going after, but from a go-to-market perspective, we started building applications because those are now use case specific and users care about what problems are you solving. And so that's kind of how we've been going to market. And, you know, and the challenge is being able to create enough horizontal capabilities where you can build verticals and adjacencies, but also being focused enough that you're actually solving customer problems today.
So now you've got the company, it's stood up, you've got customers, You got revenues. What are the things that you had to learn when you started the company that nobody told you that you wish you had been told by somebody?
I think the biggest challenge was thinking that, you know, everybody understands the data problem and that people would be able to understand that next layer, why what we're doing is different than other folks, right? And, you know, and folks like yourself who have been immersed in this space or others would get it instantly. And then we got one level down and it just like, what? It just wouldn't resonate. And so the messaging was very, very challenging, right? And to some people, to their credit, they would say, prove it. I don't believe you. Right. And so you're now like, okay. And so, you know, now you have to do pilots and you get into this cycle. And that part was probably the most challenging. And that helped us pivot so that instead of just selling a platform, here's a platform, use it however you want, to here's a platform and here's a set of capabilities that we've already built that we call applications that will solve this problem today. So, for example, we are about to launch an ASPM, you know, application security posture management solution that is going to end up in the AWS marketplace, hopefully in the next month or so, right?
That's awesome.
It's great. And we're very excited. And we, you know, we were able to, we don't have a huge lab of security experts. So we had to rely on customers to help us formulate. And it's the best way to learn because these are real customer problems. But in that process, it became very obvious that you go to a customer and say, hey, we understand you have these problems. Here's why what we do is different than these other folks that are also in this space. And by the way, when you want to go from this area to the next area, you don't have to buy a new solution because you just continue to build or we'll continue to expand. And so that message has been resonating really well. And I've always thought, you know, the Palantir approach or the, you know, these big guys and what they've done would be the way to go. What we found is solve the problems. The customers care about their problems. So with, you know, ASPM, we'll go solve that problem. We did some pilots in the industrial space early on and we had some great success, but it, you know, it required a lot of investment and, you know, we're bootstrapped. So we decided we have to pick one area to focus on and then we'll just continue to, you know, to.
You've been doing this for a couple of years now. And you guys have figured out a model where you're very comfortable with the self-funding. Where do you see that going?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's probably the one thing that keeps me up at night because now you're responsible for a lot of people, right? And you also have customers that you've made commitments to. And so it's a very interesting question. And it's really not about, it's less about dilution, less about, it's more about having control of the vision and being able to see where it is and then have it mature enough and have other folks understand it enough that they can help you shape it and help you scale it. And so that's been really the barometer for us. I think we're at that point now where we're open to having conversations because if we're going to scale at the pace that we want to scale, we're probably going to have to take some real money, right? Some meaningful money. And we take that very seriously. You know, so anytime I take someone's a dollar, whether it's a loan or, you know, an investment, you know, it keeps me up at night. And my founders are exactly the same. And so we are fortunate enough that we are like-minded and, you know, if it works. No, we're taking people's money. It has to work.
I think a lot of entrepreneurs struggle with when is the right time and may rush into taking money too early when they might have been better going a little slower and getting your startup to a better spot.
Well, and you know, naturally, people will give you advice, right? And so they haven't been through the journey. They may think this is the right path for you. If you've taken money, you have to listen to them. You have to maybe pivot. If you haven't, you know, and we listen to a lot of people. We, you know, we have great advisors that are guiding us all the time. And we're very open to that. But then it gives you the flexibility to, you know, how do you listen and how do you dialogue versus, you know, the short-term mentality like, oh, no, this isn't working, pivot, you know? And so it's a struggle. I don't know that there's the right answer, but at least that's been the framework for us.
How do you motivate yourself, given like you're sleepless and everything else that's going on?
Yeah, it's actually more fun than sleepless, to be honest. You know, I'm fortunate enough that we have a really solid leadership team, and there's three of us, and so it's quite, you know, quite easy in some sense, and we know each other. And so the ability to make decisions fast has probably been one of the best things. Like, we literally just, we have a conversation. If we can't figure it out, we'll all fly somewhere. We'll spend 2-3 days together and we'll just powwow, and then we'll make a decision and we'll move forward. And I think the most rewarding is probably the smaller things. It's just a small little milestones, little increments. And you see the amount that, you know, you produce in a small period of time with a small dedicated team. That's been probably the most fun I've had in a very long time. We're fortunate enough. We have most of our cost is offshore, so it's not daunting, but we have amazing talent, right? And so these milestones, even milestones around process, right? So as you know me, I'm a little bit more process oriented, sometimes maybe a little even controlling. And so, there were things that would just get on my nerves, like, why did we do it this way? And then in 2 months or in a month and a half, that's solved. And then we're moving to the next thing. And, we're just maturing and watching that. For me, it's just so amazingly rewarding. And then just having customers and having folks, even when you're in a meeting and you couldn't get through somebody and you couldn't get, and they see the demo and all of a sudden it's like, oh my God, I see what you're doing now. Can you guys connect to this system? Could you connect to my, my HR data? Can you connect to my CRM data? And we're not even talking about those things. We're just talking about security. But they make the connection, and all of a sudden you're like, okay, we're onto something, And so
you're selling the application. You go in, and they see the platform.
Yes.
And suddenly you're feeling like they got it. I'm getting the right
spot.
We're
getting there. We're getting there. And then finding one or two sponsors that really believe in you, that are willing to go fight the battle on your behalf inside the company, those make every bad day like disappear. It's been a great experience, to be honest.
And you've been doing this how long?
So 2 years full time, and I was an advisor for a year before that.
You don't really have a headquarters or, head office that you all go to. So you are the modern startup, geographically distributed. How does that work?
It has its challenges, but it works really well. I mean, so we're in on 3 continents and 4 sometimes, and, time zones. So we have a team in Pakistan. We have, some folks in Kenya. We bring in some folks from Latin America, and the 3 of us are distributed across the United States. So one of our co-founders is in Virginia. The other one's in the Bay Area. I'm in Los Angeles. And oftentimes they're also traveling, right? So they may be in Thailand or this. And so we're continuously distributed. So that really helped us also to be disciplined around metrics, right? And so, and with engineering, it's a lot easier nowadays to have metrics to make sure we're executing all what we want to do. And we just, we trust each other, and we really have hard conversations at times, right? And so you get that alignment going, and then it doesn't even feel like we're remote. Right. So I talk to the guys every day, probably 2-3 hours. They talk to everybody 2-3 hours. And so it feels, and then we make sure we get together, on a regular basis so that we're in the same room. Because sometimes it's easier to just be in the same room, ideating on a whiteboard. So it works really well. I don't think we'll change that model anytime soon, to be honest.
Well, you certainly don't have the cost of a physical infrastructure that gives some advantage to you to be able to do that. I suspect at some point you're gonna have to change, but I don't know.
Well, I think we've talked about, so we have a decent presence in oil and gas, and so we've talked about potentially having a small office maybe in places like Houston or the UK or something where you have a presence and maybe one of us will be there full time. But I don't think it changes the model materially, because I think the talent is going to continue to be distributed. There's talent everywhere in the world. And so if you can figure out a way to tap into that talent, you reduce, first of all, your cost, but second of all, you increase your pool, right? And so you get the best of the best of the best all the time. And again, it's just having the cadence and the discipline on how do you manage, what metrics do you measure. I believe if you incentivize people to do the right thing and they're excited about it, they don't have to be all in the office. You don't have to walk around and check, if they're working. They work whatever hours they work. So we're very flexible on that, so long as things are done and with high quality and high throughput.
You said talent's everywhere, and you certainly have found it everywhere. But what are you finding? Are you finding the reality is that there's all very limited supply of those people?
As you move up, you know, in the seniority in certain areas, whether it's AI or certain more esoteric areas, it becomes a little bit more challenging. So, for example, we're working very closely with the Bedrock team in AWS, where they're giving us resources to help solve problems for a customer, our joint customer, that we wouldn't have been able to fund ourselves, right? And so things like that, we're also starting to tap into universities so that we can collaborate with them. Because there are certain things that are just on the cutting edge that it will be very challenging to find. But in terms of just great engineers and great talent, that I think we've been doing, we've had a very good track record of finding folks. And again, it's not, there are certain things like, you know, if you're looking for Golang, you know, skills in wherever, let's say East Africa or in India, it's a bit more challenging. There aren't that many Golang engineers that have had, you know, 5 years experience. But you can find some that have maybe a year or two experience. And then, you know, and then we do a great job of training them and, you know, and just investing in them, and then they seem to do really well. Similarly, with being able to use AI to do maybe first level of code or to do QA, all of these are, I would say, areas of differentiation for us. But in large part, it's being driven by Suparna and Zubair. So they are the guys who are on the forefront. They're spending their time. And, you know Suparna, he loves to tinker. I don't know if the guy sleeps. And so they find ways to do this, and they'll ask the team, hey, go research this, go spend some more time on this. Let's figure out how to do it. And then they teach everybody else. And so it's been, you know, it's sort of a combination of both.
That's awesome. And last question, partnerships, because it was really great when you talked about people. You tied your strategy for people to partnerships to fill, especially the really advanced innovative gaps, the AWS, the university work. But you know, where do you imagine your best partnerships are going to come from?
I think our best partnerships are going to be a combination of some of the large enterprises that are winning in adjacent spaces. And some folks may, you know, including myself in previous life, would have thought of them as competitors. But I think they could be great complements. Their lane and our lane don't really intersect very much. And so I think that's one great area. The other one is, I think, the hyperscalers, you know, the AWSs of the world. They need innovation. They need, you know, nimbleness, but they have the resources and they have the reach. And so I think that's another great area. I do think the system integrators and the traditional consulting firms have a huge role to play. Even I think the sort of knowledge, I would say, consultants like the McKinsey's and the Boston, you know, the BCG group, those could be a great play for us because we're in the knowledge space, right? Our whole thing is, how do you contextualize stuff? How do you correlate information across disparate systems? And how do you enable faster decision-making, right? And so that message isn't that different than if you go to Palantir's website or Cognite's website or others. How we do it is very different, right? And so, you know, we think that there's an opportunity to go partner with some big folks that could have a material value for both ourselves and for them.
Knowing you in your earlier years, you were less likely to think about partnering. You might have seen them more as a competitor, and now That's a lesson learned. And sometimes people you think are competitors can turn into your best partners.
Absolutely. I think it's a very different mindset because, you know, if you think of the world as a zero sum game, then you know, you want to control your P's. But if you think about it, we're going to have a bigger pie. I may have to give up some things. I may have to give up portions of, you know, what we would typically do. And we have that situation right now, actually, at a customer where they have a number of these large vendors in place. And they're saying, you got to figure out how to go play with them. And we're like, happy to do it. You know, there's no resistance. And so that makes things, you know, a little bit easier.
What, coming back to you, what are your personal passions? What do you like to do when you're not working?
You know, I'm a busy body, so I love to go out. I love to explore, you know, restaurants. My friends know that I use my Google Maps as a landmark of all the, I have postcards, like all these places that I want to go to. And I'm a researcher by nature, so you know, like I was telling you, with curiosity. So I have a, so I love to explore cities. I love to travel. I travel a lot. I love wine. And I love to read, especially history, and try to make sense of how different paradigms are, you know, are interacting and stuff like that. So again, same theme.
Any blogs or podcasts that you love learning from or listening to, either personally or changing your how you think about work?
Yeah, I'm obsessed with the Diary of the CEO. I think Stephen does an amazing job of interviewing folks. And it's amazing to me how candid folks are, right? That people come on the show and they're experts, and they're, you know, in their respective areas. And I really love that. That's probably the one I follow the most. I used to follow, actually, from time to time, I still follow, what was that one? I can't remember the name of it off the top of my head. But I mean, there's a couple. But, you know, I love the leadership-related things and things that kind of help you think about, you know, how you do things or changes that are happening in medicine or in, you know, the legal profession or whatever it is, right? But it's just these experts that come on and they, you know, and you're learning from that and you're trying to apply it into your own life, or you think about, oh, how could we use technology to go impact that, you know, so that kind of stuff.
I know you love good wine, good food, and any city in the world. But so in LA, you know, the LA area, what is your favorite restaurant or restaurants?
I'm in love with this new restaurant I found not too long ago called Osti. It's an Italian restaurant. And it's a Southern Italian restaurant, and it, you know, they make everything in house. It's on 3rd Street. It's really good. There's a place actually like two doors down from it called The Little Door, and it's a modern French restaurant, and it's really, really good. There's a place in Santa Monica called Pajol that I think is also amazing. And the thing that I love about LA is it's become a destination for top chefs. So there's a restaurant that I loved in Chicago called The Goat and the Girl. And they opened the one in downtown LA. Similarly, there's a really famous Mexican chef that does modern Mexican food. And he actually had a Michelin rated restaurant in New York. And he closed that. He opened another one in Mexico City and in Oaxaca, and he opened a more casual restaurant in downtown LA called Damien. So, you know, so it's a playground for me right now. I love this city.
Yeah, we got to end it now. So it was a great conversation. I think people learned a lot about kscope.ai, and I think about your entrepreneurial spirit, what drives you and what makes it work. So thank you.
I appreciate that.
Well, I hope you enjoyed the interview with Yonatan. He is a true Renaissance man with a number of lessons we can take away. First, like every entrepreneur I interview, they all express intense curiosity and being lifelong learners as core attributes. I believe this is foundational to being a successful entrepreneur. Second, he discussed how purpose is a powerful self-motivator, and that has guided his entrepreneurial focus. Now, I also believe it leads to authentic passion for your business. And this is necessary to deal with all the problems you're going to face as an entrepreneur. Third, he was very thoughtful in seeking out co-founders, and this has allowed him to share the load and go faster. More importantly, is a mix of strengths that a few overlaps. So Yonatan brings customer focus, identifying trends, marketing and messaging, and the ability to build strong partnerships. It is important to ensure a good balance with co-founders. Now, lastly, Dave remains self-funded, specifically waiting for the right time to bring in outside capital. This does create stress as it brings a sense of responsibility, especially to your employees and customers. But it also leads to better long-term financial foundations that will be attractive to investors. Once institutional investors are brought in, it changes the dynamics on strategy and overall decision-making. You need to be thoughtful on when capital is really needed. Now, I hope you enjoyed today's podcast. We'll be back soon with another episode of Scrappy Startups. Please support our sponsors, Joogi, J-O-O-G-I, a scrappy startup on the Google and Apple App Store, and Last Best Place Brewing in Bozeman, Montana. Stop by for a beer or ask for them at restaurants, bars, and grocery stores throughout Montana.